So hello and welcome to the next instalment in the Tech Journeys podcast. I'm Sean Ryness, and today we are joined by Ben Mancini. Ben is the development manager at Redgate Software, responsible for three software engineering teams. He's also an agile coach and the co-founder of the Cambridge Agile Exchange. So hiya Ben, how you doing?
Hi Sean, hi everyone.
Hi, how you doing? You okay?
I'm good, thanks. Yeah.
Good. You had a busy day, or?
It's not been too bad, and I put that mainly down to booking out my diary for this.
Okay.
So thank you.
Yeah, managed to get you an afternoon off. Are you are you working from home at the minute then?
Yeah, I mean, we've been working from home since end of February, beginning of March, and
really. Right. Okay.
Yeah, the entire company went remote at that point. And I think initially, because the same of everyone, we expected lockdown to just be until autumn. We were sort of anticipating coming back into the office in September. And then we were told, no, the office won't be open until Q4. And then it became spring next year.
Right. And then, okay.
And then it moved to the summer next year. So at the moment, on paper, we won't have been into the office for a year and a half by the time this finishes.
Are you enjoying that? Do you like it working from home? Or?
Yeah, I mean, it's been tough along the way. You know, it was a big change for everyone, and being in a managerial sort of role, it's tough to have the in-depth one-to-one conversations that you could normally have across from a desk from someone when you're remote on a Zoom call. So that's taken some getting used to. But I think for the most part, the entire company is really moved to remote working really well.
Right.
I think part of that has been the culture of the company really that's helped.
Yeah. Well, to be fair, I think Redgate Software have got a very, very good reputation within the technology market. So if anybody can do that well, I expect it's them.
Yeah, it's pretty well hard earned, but it's definitely helped us, I think.
Good stuff. So obviously, like I mentioned to you, Ben, the reason that I wanted to invite you onto the podcast was it's about your kind of journey through technology to where you've been today, to be honest with you, that interests me, and I expect will interest other people. A lot of people are kind of looking at technology as a career opportunity or a kind of career change for themselves these days. And more so with everything that's going on, we're seeing more and more people come through like tech academies and things like that. And one of the things that really interested me about your experience was the fact that your initial role over at Viva, working as a customer services representative, did very, very well at Viva. And then a few steps on, you're the kind of agile coach and development manager for one of the most reputable businesses in Cambridge, to be honest with you, from a technical perspective. So I just wanted to dig into that a little bit deeper. Probably first 20 minutes or so, we'll have a chat on that. And then we've had quite a few questions submitted around agile practices and agile development. Nothing too high level. It's more of an understanding of kind of what advice have you got for other people out there who maybe want to follow in your footsteps, and kind of understand how does somebody actually go from working for a company like Aviva at the kind of lower tier and then end up going from, to be fair, customer services through to Scrum Master. I mean, that's a really, really good achievement. So why don't we start by you telling me a little bit about, I think where we like to start usually is how did you become interested in technology? Where did that come from?
I think, to be honest, it came from childhood. When I was growing up, we did the typical family thing of having a home computer, and we had a lot of those. You know, the first one we had was a Sinclair Spectrum, I think, with a tape deck on it. And, the purpose of having that in the house was to be able to do, you know, work, schoolwork, those sorts of things on it. And it was never used for that at all. The ulterior motive was for me and my brother to play games on it. And it kind of went from there, really. You know, the home life was the thing that really got me interested in tech, computers, video games more than anything else. That sounds like quite a geeky answer, but tech was always interesting in around home life. School, on the other hand, the the sort of education we had around IT was pretty lacking, to be honest. And I guess that's why it's something I've got a firm focus on now, really, is supporting STEM education. And there's a couple of things I've done the last couple of years, mainly, that help hopefully support that. School didn't really encourage it. And I didn't take it as a subject in college, really. It was only really when I got into work that technology became this big thing. I say to my own kids that having at least a basic understanding of computers is really important now, because it's very difficult to have a job now where you don't rely on an aspect of that.
No, that's true. So my mother, she's not tech savvy at all. And because of this pandemic, she's ended up losing her job. And she's really struggling to find employment now. And the reason for that is it's because everything is so remote working. And she can't even use a kind of basic kind of office setup on a computer. And she's struggling to find work just because of that fact as well.
I mean, for me, this pandemic has really shown just how poorly funded support for STEM subjects in school is. I've spoken to numerous teachers over the last couple of years about the support that they have, the funding they have to teach kids about science, technology, mathematics subjects, those sorts of areas, and it's really lacking compared to English. I would challenge anyone to say that STEM subjects are less important than the typical GCSEs we take, because as we're all starting to find now working remote, you really do need these skills. And they're the sort of skills that you need if you're applying for a new job.
So. Yeah. I'd say that as kind of society moves forwards and as the years kind of tick on as well, it's going to become more important that the whole education system is reviewed, because as times change, so do the skills that people need. So that's definitely something that needs recognising.
I mean, the other thing that concerns me around the sort of IT education sector really is the gender split as well. We talk about the gender split in work. Well, that starts with education. Many teachers I've spoken to will talk about the fact that at first school, when they're doing basic IT and Scratch and coding, the basic building blocks there, the split is 50-50 because the entire class does it. And when it becomes an optional subject to take at GCSE, that percentage drops down to maybe 25%, 20% of females. Right. By the time you're at college and university, it's 10% or less. And then at university, it's maybe one or two people in that class.
Oh, that's unbelievable. Well, there's a guy that I know, he's the CTO for a business in Manchester, a guy called Liam. And he helps a lot, similar to yourself, within schools and things like that when it comes to kind of technology. And he actually shared something a few days ago in one of the groups that we're in, whereas he's running a coding boot camp at the minute.
Yeah.
And there's a girl who's come to the coding boot camp who's about 24, and he was talking to her and he was asking her, why is she only getting into technology now? And her answer was that she tried to get into top-notch technology when she was in the later years of school, but her teacher actually said to her, you can't do that class because you'll be the only girl in it. Didn't allow her to do the IT course that she wanted to do at the time.
Yeah, and then we struggled to wonder why we have the gender split that we have. Yeah. Studies have shown that having an equal distribution of genders in IT helps teams. It makes them more productive. It makes them more efficient and effective. And yet we're still failing to plug that gap in education, really. Yeah. And that's the key point for me, really, is if you fail to do that, then it's just an upwards collapse of it, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it's at least it's something that's kind of coming to people's attention these days. I think over the at least the last 5 years, it's becoming a bit more kind of dominant and more talked about within the industry, which is great. Which is fantastic.
This has got a long runoff.
From a recruitment perspective, we sometimes see companies, not from a kind of gender bias perspective, but if they've got a number of good candidates that they could offer a job to, they may sometimes kind of sway just to build the balance in the teams and things like that. So Obviously, you come from quite untraditional route into, yes, into technology. Did you study law? Did I see you studied law?
So when I was at college, I had no plans to go into IT whatsoever. So I was studying law, English language, history, because I wanted to be a barrister. You know, people that know me well will know that I like a good debate or likely an argument. But yeah, I mean, that was the thing that really interested me, and it's something that still interests me, but I kind of looked at the costs of that and it just priced me out of it, really, because in order to complete that, I would be tens of thousands of pounds in debt.
And, oh, really?
After college, I kind of looked at that typical gap year of, well, I'll go and get a job for a year and decide what I want to do, whether I want to go to university. And I applied at Aviva, which was Norwich Union at that point, as a customer service representative. And I thought, I'll do this for a year and see where I end up. And the typical thing that happens is once you start earning a wage, that puts you off wanting to be in debt and, you know, going to university and studying when you've got this job and it's quite stable and you feel like you're starting to do some good work there. So it closed down that avenue to me. And I worked in customer service for a couple of years at Aviva and moved around a bit. And then I got an opportunity to go and do some testing on a product that was going to be released by Aviva.
So can I just ask on that before you move on? Did you get the opportunity to do some testing because of previous experience that you'd had playing around with technology, or was it just an opportunity that presented itself?
I think it helped. I think it was a case of, hey, look, we've got this chance to go and get involved in doing some what was user experience testing of this product. Is anyone interested? And I just kind of stuck my hand up. I was getting a little bit bored and feeling like I was getting a bit stale doing the customer service side. So I stuck my hand up for it. I obviously showed some interest because they picked me for it. And I did that for about 3 months, I think. And it wasn't a job at the end of that. There was no guarantee of a job or anything. But a couple of weeks later, they posted some roles for some test analysts in their user acceptance team. And I kind of thought, well, I've done this recently. I'll apply for it and see what happens. And I got the job.
Right.
So I moved across to what was, you know, a fairly big IT function. You know, Aviva at that point was a very big company. It still is. I think it still employs something like 35,000 people across the world. But at that point, it was even bigger. And I moved across to IT, started as a test analyst, the typical user acceptance testing, UAT style role, where you're right at the end of the IT life cycle and you've got what you think is 4 weeks to test something that ends up being maybe 2 weeks or a week. And you purposefully have to go and break these things. It sounded like a great job to me, you know, you break things. And that was really my foot into IT.
Right, okay.
I kind of progressed in testing. I became a lead tester, I think, after the first year. So I was leading a small team of testers. And then I became a test manager. And that's where people management started to become a big part of what I was doing, with project management there as well. And I became a program test manager, where I was looking after a number of test managers and programs. Got involved in program management at that point as well. And then I was doing release test management, which is being responsible for the entire life cycle of testing at Aviva still. And I was quite happy with my lot at that point.
Yeah.
I had a good job. It was a stable job. It was interesting work. And then I bumped into a guy who had the coolest name for a job that I'd ever seen, which was Scrum Master. I had no idea what it was, but it sounded really cool. And the more I spoke to him, the more earth-shattering that sort of job sounded to me. It was completely different to what I was doing. You know, the role I was doing was in a very structured, what we would call a waterfall-style environment, where you get your tasks given to you once another area's completed their tasks, you do your tasks, and then you pass it to someone else to complete theirs.
Yeah.
And he was doing it completely differently. You know, he had testers and business analysts and users all working together in very, very short windows to go away and build and test something and then get it out to production. And that sounded crazy to me because, you know, with my testing hat on, I thought, well, that's a big risk. you know, we're putting stuff out there really quickly. You're not getting a lot of time to test it. Surely that's going to break things. But it didn't. It worked. And I think that was really the foot in the door that I needed to really change quite significantly the job I was doing.
So how did Aviva react from you kind of changing that methodology internally? Was that a challenge for you, or was it something that they kind of gave you the freedom to do?
No, I mean, I left Aviva a number of years ago, and I've heard it's changed quite fundamentally since then. But at that time, Agile was just this project, this mini prototype thing that they were trying in one of their areas. And it was quite hard to get involved in that without purposefully trying to maneuver yourself into a job that was responsible for that. So one of my last jobs at Aviva was as a release management coordinator. So that was being responsible for the big bulky releases that Aviva would do maybe once, twice, three or four times a year, where they would drop lots of changes into a production environment. And that would typically be done over a weekend from about Saturday at midnight through to about Sunday afternoon, because that was the least busy time to do it.
Yeah.
And that carries untold amounts of risk, because you are switching off production systems, very difficult to roll back changes if they go wrong, so you have to fix forward. And it was still that very archaic waterfall process. But that was the role I was doing. And then I met this Scrum Master. And I basically just shadowed him and became his stalker for the next 3 months, really, and just was picking up as much knowledge as I could from him and watching and observing. His name was Steve Grafton, by the way. So if he ever listens to this, thank you very much, Steve, but for completely changing my job in life.
Yeah.
And then I tried to bring some of that back to the area I was working in. And, you know, in answer to your question, that was incredibly hard to do, because we'd been drilled for years in this is how you do IT, this is how you deliver change and manage change, and you absolutely can't risk putting stuff into production without a big process around it of checks and balances to make sure it works. So trying to get a function which wasn't even a software development function to try and adopt some agile practice was really, really difficult. It took the best part of 6 months. And even then, I made the error, which I've talked about previously, of trying to do Agile by the book, which is reading something like the Scrum Guide and then applying it religiously to the teams that I was working with.
Yeah.
And initially it worked, but then people start to ask questions and challenge it, and I had no answers because I didn't have the experience other than this book.
Right. Yeah.
It didn't work as successfully at that point.
Yeah, we get a lot of companies. One of the questions that we would ask, we'll get onto this in a bit, but a lot of the questions that we've got asked is, later on we'll be asking you, what is Agile? And the reason for that is everybody seems to have a different variation of what Agile looks like. But then when you discuss this with customers, when you're kind of... when we're part, the customers that we're partners with, and we're talking about the kind of methodology through the business, there's always a quote that comes up: you've got to be agile with agile. It's not take it by the book and apply it. You've got to take the principles, find out how they work with that team that you're working with, and kind of be agile in the way that you implement agile.
Yeah, it's absolutely right. And for me, it's a real soapbox that I get on about, you know, the agile industry as it stands today. You know, it's more than one podcast warrants, I think, to talk about. But it's, you know, it is an industry. It is a money-making industry now, Agile. And that means you have to be incredibly careful what you do, because at the end of all of this process are people. There's people in your teams, there's people you work with, and there's customers. And woe betide you if you mess that up. And you have a real risk of messing that up quite badly. And I've done that myself. And, you know, I've blogged about that and talked about the many, many mistakes I've made using Agile techniques. So something you need to be careful of.
Right. Okay.
That's really my foot into
technology.
Scrum Master. Yeah.
Right. Okay. Well, one thing I would ask then, so would you say that you, you credit Aviva for giving you that opportunity and kind of getting you to where you are today, or do you think you would have still somehow ended up within technology?
I would say yes and no. Yes, because they let me do this thing with a department for 6 months.
Yeah.
And then we revert back anyway.
Right.
And no, I guess, because in order to really become a Scrum Master, I had to take redundancy and leave Aviva.
Oh, okay.
At that point, it wasn't really a big, serious thing that they were doing. It absolutely is now, and fair play to Aviva for, you know, investing in it.
Yeah.
But at that point, I had to move on, and that's where I then moved to a company called Velocix as an out-and-out Scrum Master at that point.
So I've done some recruitment for Velocix. Is it Nokia? Yeah.
It is, yeah. So it was Velocix, which was a Cambridge-based company, which was all around CDN hardware and technology. So CDN's a cash delivery network. So if you think of Amazon, Love Film, Netflix, those sorts of things where you are watching and consuming content, CDN networks are what bring that content down through the network and cache it. So you don't have buffering appear on your screen.
Right, okay.
So that's what CDN networks do. They're very reliant on IP and telephony technology, which is why they were then acquired by Alcatel-Lucent, who were then acquired by Nokia.
Right.
And that all happened in the 2 years I was there. So it was Yeah.
Right, okay. And then you went through from Nokia and you were with EPOS for about a year.
Yeah.
And then ultimately ended up with Redgate Software. So do you want to give us an overview of what your kind of responsibilities are and what you're doing at Redgate then at the moment?
Yeah, so Redgate, I think, I really landed on my feet there. I was very lucky to get that role when it came up. It's quite a difficult role to describe because it's not, when I talk about a development manager role, you would expect a development manager to be very close to engineering, have a background in software development, be working day to day with software engineers. And that's not what the role is at Redgate, which is why we, I think sometimes in the past we've had difficulty recruiting for that role because of the name of that role. Actually, what that role is it's three different things, which I think the background I've had has certainly helped me in that role. You're a program manager because you're managing a program of work and change. So you'll look after multiple teams that are probably all working on the same products as part of a solution. You are a senior people manager because you are managing the managers that manage those teams, if that makes sense. And you are also, ideally, you've got a good set of experience in agile techniques because you also need to be an agile coach or have Scrum Master type experience where you're able to really go into a team and help them deliver as efficiently, as effectively as possible. And that, for me, is a big plank of agile. So that's the three aspects of the role that all come under this description of development manager.
Right, okay. Okay, well, to be fair, I think that's a good overview for the first 20, 25 minutes of... it kind of gives us the credibility of why we should be asking Ben a few additional questions on Agile. First of all, from your perspective, you've already mentioned that there's quite a bit of confusion between different businesses, different teams as to what constitutes Agile, what is Agile.
Yeah.
There's been many a time where we've taken a job description or we've been working with a partnership with a business and they've told us that they practice agile practices, their teams are agile. You tell that to a candidate, the candidate goes in, he starts on the first day and then he calls you up saying, "You told me this was agile."
We see
that's a common occurrence, to be honest with you. And it's quite a difficult one to get around from our perspective. Mm. So give us an overview from Ben's perspective. What's agile?
Well, I mean, the answer I always give to this when I'm initially asked this is the typical politician's response, which is, "Well, what do you think is agile?" and that's a bit of a palm off. But the reason I ask that is because, exactly as you've described, everyone has got a different opinion on what they think agile is.
Yeah.
So for me to provide that, you know, that holy grail of what agile is, I think would be incorrect. What I think agile is it's a way of delivering valuable software to customers as efficiently and as effectively as possible without harming anyone. And I really emphasize that final point because if you do this badly, you really can harm not just your customers, but the people you work with and the people you have to come into the office and sit next to every day.
Right.
So that's why I always suggest that you tread carefully and you do a lot of observing before you go in and try and change anything.
Well, that kind of brings me to a question that we got from one of the managers that we work with in Cambridge. He wanted us to ask you, typically, where do companies or teams tend to go wrong when it comes to implementing Agile within their business?
Oh, so many. So the typical approach that maybe an SME or even, well, enterprises are renowned for doing this is you will go and hire a bunch of what you believe are agile experts. You know, I'm not going to name any companies here, but we all know the big consultants. Some of them are working with the government at the moment and doing a fantastic job of messing up Excel spreadsheets.
Yeah.
Well, you'll go and hire one of those companies. You'll pay a lot of money for their expert agile consultants to come in. Those agile consultants will come in and tell you how to do things by the book. You'll then go and try and implement it by the book. Those consultants have left, which means you don't have the expertise in your business to do it, and you'll fail. And that then leaves the C-level leadership with a bad taste in their mouth because they've spent all of this money on something that doesn't work. And it leaves their teams hating Agile because they were promised the earth and all of our jobs changed, all of our processes changed that we're really comfortable with, and now it's not working. So we hate Agile. And that's typically where I've ended up coming into a company or a business and then trying to fix it. Successfully and unsuccessfully, I'd add, in case.
Yeah. So would you say that in regards to like consultancies or agile contractors and agile transformation managers, these kind of guys, it'd be a far better approach to teach your existing staff or at least bring in a permanent employee who's going to be doing that work as opposed to kind of consulting?
Yes and no. I absolutely think genuine agile consultancies and contractors are needed for this. Yeah. You know, you can't just do all of this in-house. You can't train your people just in-house. You need those experts to come in either as a contractual basis or a consultancy basis to help. But you need to just observe to start with. Look at your existing processes in your teams. Where are the bottlenecks? Where are the bits that break? What are the high risk scenarios that your teams have to deal with? And look at tackling them first. You don't even have to call it Agile. It's an efficiency program more than anything else around some of this. And just look at that first. Look at how the teams deal with that, how they talk to each other, how they talk to different departments. And start from there, and then start to train some of your people up to do the job that the consultants and the contractors are doing before you even think about trying to do anything as grand as what people call an agile transformation, because that way just lies error and failure. So that's the first thing I would suggest, is just come in and watch. Start to train people up on the key roles and keep them there for a period of time before you then start to try and change anything.
Okay. Are there any kind of key resources that you've found to be very helpful over the years, or any, I'd say like maybe resources, training material, courses that you've been on? Like say somebody's listening now and they're going through a process at the minute of trying to become more agile as a development team. Are there any kind of recommendations that you would have?
There's a few, and I always temper these answers with, but also find your own way. Which again sounds like a real politician's answer, but Agile as an industry is a money-making industry now. You can go on a certification course for pretty much anything you can think about that's got Agile tacked on the end of it in order to make it sound like it's going to really help you. And I would say from experience and from speaking to hundreds of people that have done many of these certification courses, most of them aren't worth the money. You can save that money and do self-training and just shadowing people that are doing this job in order to get the same experience. And in fact, you'll get more experience because the certification courses typically deal with best practice outcomes. So if you do this, if you adopt Scrum, your teams will all adopt it and love it. It will all work perfectly well. Your stakeholders will love you. You'll deliver software instantaneously and you'll save loads of money. That's not what happens in real life. What happens is people. People have different opinions, different views. People go through the change curve at different speeds as well, which means not everyone's going to get on board at the same time. You will have people that are actively trying to sabotage what you're doing. And it takes time. You're not going to deliver software faster or cheaper when you first adopt Agile. It's going to be more expensive. It's going to take more time. This is what we forget sometimes when we're trying to sell the Agile vision to companies, is that this is a significant change for a company. So the sorts of things I would suggest are speak to people that are already doing the job, ideally with more than 6 months experience, because they'll have lived through a release that's not gone particularly well. They'll have lived through a stakeholder being really unhappy with a demo of a product. They'll have had some of the typical interactions that someone that's been doing this for years has, so they'll know how to deal with them. I may be plugging my own thing here, but go to meetup groups. Yeah. One of the reasons that me and a couple of the other guys that I founded Cambridge Agile Exchange for, we did that because we enjoyed getting together to share our experience with each other at work. And we did that off our own cuff. We did that because we wanted to talk to each other. We enjoyed sharing. And we wanted to do that wider. And we only kicked that off because we thought we had a bit of knowledge that we could share that might help one or two people. And 3 years down the line, that meetup is still going really successfully, ideally helping lots of people. So look for meetups. Look for people that are doing this role. By all means, read some of the material that's out there, but just temper that with the fact that that book or that certification course was done at a point in time to solve a particular problem.
Yeah.
So I'll give an example of that. The Spotify model that gets talked about in Agile a lot, with teams of people coming together and being really successful. That was used at Spotify for a couple of years before they changed to something else. And it suddenly became externally this nirvana that every team should head for. Everyone should adopt the Spotify model. And it doesn't work for most people because it was made for that company, specifically for that company, to solve a specific set of problems that they had at that point in time. It's not something that they've packaged up to sell to other people. So right. By all means, read about it.
Yeah.
Don't necessarily copy it.
Right. Okay. Yeah, it does make sense. One thing on that then. So we're all this, exactly what we're doing now and everything about our whole business model, to be honest with you, is promoting kind of community and meetup groups and things like that.
Yeah.
If you've got a link that you can send me later, maybe to give some information on the Agile Exchange meetup group, yeah. I'll make sure that it goes out in the marketing with this podcast.
Yeah, great.
So anybody who's interested can sign up to that, sign up to your meetup group, etc.
I mean, the great thing now is that it's fully remote because, we're meeting up in person. So, the membership is certainly increasing across the country and even in South America for some
reason. Oh, really?
Yeah. We have a South American following now, which is quite strange, but useful.
An opportunity to go over there and have some... So host a proper meetup when everything if everything returns back to normal.
Yeah.
So another question that came in: are there any? Are there any particular mistakes that you see businesses make when kind of reverting over to Agile, or any kind of typical scenarios that kind of seem to repeat themselves that if people know about in advance, they could hopefully avoid?
Yeah, I've touched on these earlier, but the two typical ones that I've seen and I've done myself are, the first is to try and do all of this by the book.
Yeah.
So you read, something, I keep using the Scrum Guide, but that's typically the one that I see that gets abused incorrectly, is that you'll read that and then you're going to try and apply that to your teams. And Scrum is just one of hundreds of different techniques that has got an agile flavor to it that you can use. And if you try and jam that into your own teams, your own company, your own divisions, that's not going to work in many cases, and it will actually make it worse and it will annoy your staff. So that's the one that I've done in the past, and it led to incredible heartache in the team that I was working with because they were being forced into something and they lost a lot because of the fact that I forced them to adopt Scrum.
Yeah.
So that was a real lesson learned for me. And it was a lesson that was learned in real upset and difficulty with that team that I had caused because I'd forced them to adopt something that they weren't comfortable with, didn't understand, and to be honest, didn't work for them.
Yeah.
Because I'd read this book, I thought I knew everything.
Yeah.
And I didn't.
The beauty of that, though, in hindsight, you're the kind of person who can actually look back at that and take responsibility for it. I expect there are a lot of people who would have said it was the team's fault, not yours.
Yeah, and that's the danger.
Says a lot about your character, yeah. To be honest.
And I guess the second one is again, I've touched on, is sending 20 people out onto a Scrum Master course. It's a 2-day course. You'll learn the absolute basics. You won't learn about the experience that comes with that role. You won't learn about the things that will go wrong and how to deal with them. And at the end of that, you have a 45 question quiz, I think, which is multiple choice. You have to get a very low mark to pass it. And at the end of that, you are called a certified Scrum Master, nice. Which I've seen firsthand destroys departments if that person then comes back and is put in a position of responsibility with a team and has only got that to rely on. It led to the person that did that course quitting the company within 6 months of doing the course, and me then having to spend the next 9 months trying to fix that team or set of teams, all for the cost of a £350 course.
Right, okay.
Nothing thousands. So.
Right. No, good. Yeah, good overview. Thank you. I think that kind of, we're coming up to the 40 minutes, and I always try and I like to keep it at the 40 minutes because everybody's busy. If we wang on too long, we don't want to be boring people. But a couple of additional questions. So what's next for Ben? Have you got targets in mind for yourself that you want to be achieving from where you are at the moment? Kind of it's to get an understanding of how would somebody else follow in your footsteps, where are you going?
I think for me, I think Redgate will have to carry me out in a box, to be honest, to move on from there. For me, it's really been the nirvana of places that I want to work. And I'm not saying that because it's my current employer. I'm saying that because it genuinely is the place where I've got absolute freedom to do the things that really appeal to me for my job as an agile coach, particularly, and as a people manager. So I see me just wanting to help my teams be as effective as they can and for people to be happy. And when I'm talking about people, I'm talking about my teams and the people that use those products. I think that's all you can really hope for, really, is that the people that end up using your products enjoy them and that they're valuable and that the people you work with enjoy their job. So that's it sounds like a very fluffy unicorn-y story. That's what I want to do. I know lots of people talk about wanting to work at somewhere like Google or Facebook, but I know people who have worked at those places, and all places have their difficulties.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you know Chen? Chen?
Yeah.
I helped Chen move to Cambridge a few years ago. I actually helped him, and then he joined a business in Cambridge. He was at Redgate. He's now with Facebook.
He is,
Yeah, he's with Facebook now, but he's on the podcast with us in a couple of weeks' time.
Ah, excellent.
It's going to be having a chat with Chen about his journey.
Hello to him for me.
Yeah, he's a good guy, Chen.
He's a great guy.
I remember him very well from helping him move across. Okay, what advice would you give somebody who wanted to follow in similar footsteps to yourself? So maybe not from a technology background, untraditional, didn't do the computer science degree, but maybe has that kind of passion for technology and would like to get into it from a more kind of commercial perspective?
Don't lose faith, I guess, is the answer I'd give. A lot of the jobs I've done have been really difficult. I'm not going to lie. IT jobs are not easy for, aspects of the job that you do. You have to, work with people that have got lots of different opinions to you. You have to try and come to a consensus, which is not always the best outcome that everyone wants. And you have to work with very demanding deadlines sometimes. But keeping the faith of actually, I feel like I'm adding value here, I'm helping, is really important in this sort of job. And absolutely, you do not need to have a computer science background to do this job. I've never had a computer science degree background or anything like that. I didn't do university courses on it. But I had an interest in IT, and that was enough. And I think in some ways that's actually helped me speak to engineers, because I don't have the background in software development. It means I get them to think about it in much more common terms than the technical terms that we'll sometimes throw around in our teams. So if they can explain it in a way that I understand, I always call this the idiot test with me. If they can explain it and I get it, then we've probably built something that our users are going to understand, and it's going to be a good product because it's going to be simple. You know, Redgate's slogan is ingeniously simple, and we really do need to live that when we're building products. It needs to be something you can pick up and understand really quickly.
Okay. Yeah. Good. Thank you. And last one, what would you say is the biggest challenge in the industry right now? Is there any kind of one particular challenge that needs tackling, needs discussing, and that people need help with?
Can I cheat and give two?
Yeah. Two's good. I prefer two.
So there's one that's specific to my background, which is around Agile, which is the danger of it eating itself as an industry rather than actually trying to help people, which is it seems to be a lot about making money at the moment rather than actually helping companies and teams and customers. So the advice I'd give there is to tread carefully and always do your research. And I guess the second big issue that's facing all of us right now, not just in IT, is remote working. We at Redgate, I've talked about us having a strong culture, which I think has helped us. But, you know, that was earned face-to-face before we went remote.
Yeah.
And we have to spend a lot of time intentionally working on that culture whilst we're remote to continue to make remote working work well. So it's something that I think we really do need to put effort into, intentional effort, not just a slight consideration of, you know, are we using the right tools? Are we making sure our people are okay? But we need to spend a lot of time on things like well-being and work-life balance, because it's very easy now working remote to fall into the trap of always being available. You know, right now, talking to you right now, my work desk is next to my bed. So it would be incredibly easy for me to roll off my bed in the morning, straight into work, and roll off my desk onto my bed at 9 or 10.
Yeah.
And knowing when to have that split throughout the day is something that specifically at Redgate we've spent a lot of time working on, is making sure that we are forcing people to get up from their desks. So that's the challenge, I think, is how do we look after our people when we're working remote?
No, that's interesting that you say that, actually, because we ran a round table event with three CTOs from different technology businesses. It was only a few weeks ago. And discussing the implications of remote working. What should we be looking out for? How are people going to need to be supported? How will it affect culture, etc.? And off the back of that, one of the biggest things that came out was actually mental health.
Yeah. So
it's just making sure that you're supporting everybody's mental health when it comes to kind of working on their own, being siloed, etc. So off the back of that, then we actually span up to additional events where we had a clinical psychologist called Dr. Hannah Taylor, who came on with us to kind of talk about how you can support your mental health while working remotely. And then we had another lady who joined us who is a specialist in meditation, so wellness, mindfulness meditation. And she kind of gave us some tips and advice on kind of how to look after your mental well-being whilst working from home. So it's definitely a topic that's of interest at the minute, and something that's really, people are giving it attention, which is good.
Yeah, and that's great. And you know, particularly what you've done there, Sean, in you know, doing those two specific meetups to talk about this, because it's something that we don't talk about enough, and it's so important at the moment, is mental health. It's very easy to fall into the trap of forgetting to look after yourself in this sort of environment that we're in now. That's a good thing to do, I think, and I'd love us to do that.
Yeah, well, we actually recorded all the events and sent them out to all our customers, and there was definitely tens of people who came back that said they'd taken things out of the events and implemented into the businesses, and it had really helped them. So Yeah, it's all about giving back.
Yeah.
No, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for coming on, Ben.
For having me.
Yeah, like I said, send over the some information on the Agile Exchange meetup so that I can get that out with any marketing on this episode. But apart from that, I'll speak to you again soon.
Thanks, Sean. Thanks, everyone.
Yeah. Thanks, Ben. See you later.
Bye.
Bye.